The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
We're looking to the future on this week's podcast with disturbing visions of what's to come from the Canadian author Emily St. John Mandel and the Austrian writer Clemens J. Zetz. Zetz has published a series of award-winning novels since his 2007 debut, Zöhne und Planeten, as well as short stories, poetry and plays. Ross Benjamin's translation of his third novel, Indigo, is Zetz's first appearance in English. He joins us to explore the mysterious illness at the heart of the book and to explain why he wound up putting himself in his own unsettling fiction. But before we turn to Zetz's patchwork novel, we're investigating a sickness of an altogether more deadly kind with Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11. Recently longlisted for America's National Book Award, Mandel's fourth novel follows a deadly flu which spreads like wildfire through our interconnected world, killing 99% of the world's population within a matter of weeks. Leaping between Armageddon and the aftermath, Mandel imagines a world 20 years after the apocalypse, a world without air travel, antibiotics or the internet, where survivors search for a stable future among the ruins of civilization. Here we find Kirsten, a leading lady in a travelling theatre company, picking her way through unfamiliar territory near Lake Michigan on a sweltering July day, going through her lines for an upcoming performance of King Lear, Weapons at the Ready, in case of an ambush.
They were no more than 2 hours out from St. Deborah by the water now. The Lear rehearsal had dissipated midway through the fourth act, everyone tired, tempers fraying in the heat. They stopped to rest the horses, and Kirsten, who didn't feel like resting, walked a few paces down the road to throw knives at a tree. She threw from 5 paces, from 10, from 20, the satisfying sound of the blades hitting wood. When the symphony began to move again, she climbed up into the back of the second caravan, where Alexandra was resting and mending a costume. "Okay," Alexandra said, picking up an earlier conversation. "So when you saw the computer screen in Traverse City, what about it?" In Traverse City, the town they'd recently left, an inventor had rigged an electrical system in an attic. It was modest in scope, a stationary bicycle that when pedaled vigorously could power a laptop, but the inventor had grander aspirations. The point wasn't actually the electrical system. The point was that he was looking for the internet. A few of the younger symphony members had felt a little thrill when he'd said this, remembered the stories they'd been told about Wi-Fi and the impossible-to-imagine cloud, wondered if the internet might still be out there somehow, invisible pinpricks of light suspended in the air around them. "Was it the way you remembered?" Alexandra asked. "I don't really remember what computer screens looked like," Kirsten admitted. The second caravan had particularly bad shocks, and riding in it always made her feel like her bones were rattling. "How could you not remember something like that? It was beautiful." "I was 8, Kirsten said. Alexandra nodded, unsatisfied and obviously thinking that if she'd seen the lit-up computer screen when she was 8, she'd have remembered it. In Traverse City, Kirsten had stared at the "This webpage is not available" message on the screen. She didn't seriously believe that the inventor would be able to find the internet, but she was fascinated by electricity. She harbored visions of a lamp with a pink shade on a side table, a nightlight shaped like a puffy half moon, a chandelier in a dining room, a brilliant stage. The inventor had pedaled frantically to keep the screen from flickering out, explaining something about satellites. Alexandra had been enraptured, the screen a magical thing with no memories attached. August had stared at the screen with a lost expression.
We've all lived the apocalypse already 1,000 times in a host of disaster movies. Mm-hmm. But as Jeevan points out in the novel, in the cinema, there's the apocalypse, then afterwards, there's a blank. Was that true. One of the motivations for the novel, to kind of explore this blank?
Absolutely. I was much more interested in writing about the afterward than And what I see is very well-covered ground, which is the horror and the chaos and the mayhem that would come, I believe, immediately following a societal collapse. To me, it was more interesting to imagine what comes after all that, say 15, 20 years down the road, as a new culture begins to emerge and as people begin to reconcile their memories of this lost world with finding a way to move forward in the new one.
So what did it start with? Was there a kind of a kernel, an inspiration, an image? Where did it go?
There was. The book started with the image of an actor dying on stage in the fourth act of King Lear, which is, of course, the scene that opens the book. And I had that, I suppose, before I knew that it would be post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, so you had the scene from the old world
Wanted to... Yeah. My original conception of the book was that it would be set entirely in the present world, that it would be a very quiet sort of literary effort about the life of an actor in a regional Shakespearean company. But I found myself thinking about something that I've been wanting to write about for a while, which is the awe I feel at this extraordinary world in which we find ourselves. Which is, of course, in many ways quite appalling. But at the same time, somebody walked into this room this morning, flipped a switch, the room was flooded with electric light. Our rubbish is taken away from the curb and we take it outside. If you're in trouble, you call the police and they show up. These are incredible things that I think we very easily take for granted, to the extent that we almost don't see them anymore. And it seemed to me that one way to write about those things, which is to say to consider the modern world, would be to write about their absence. So for that reason, I thought it would be interesting to make it a post-apocalyptic novel.
Where did Kirsten come from, your actor 20 years down the line, doing her Shakespeare?
What she came from originally was a 2007 production of King Lear at the Public Theater in New York, which had, I found it to be an extraordinary bit of staging. There were three little girls on stage as the audience entered. They had non-speaking roles as child versions of Lear's daughters. And it was such an interesting effect. So my original idea had been that this production of King Lear, wherein the actor dies of a heart attack, would have those three little girls. And then I found myself wondering, like, you know, of course some people would survive an apocalyptic event, and how interesting it might be if one of those little girls had a new life in the new world.
There's a great big fat hole in the book, those first unspeakable years when everyone was traveling.
Right, which, that is the line.
And it's exactly that territory, as you say, which is classically given over to post-apocalyptic fiction.
Exactly.
Was it very much you just wanted to break new ground? You didn't want to do that?
Exactly. I love Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It's one of my favorite post-apocalyptic novels, but I very consciously did not want to write that book. I was not particularly interested in writing a horror novel with the cannibalism and rape and everything else that seems to come in these books. It wasn't my field of interest. I did think it would be interesting to look at the moment just after all that.
It's a novel of endings on a personal level, as
exactly.
well as that of civilization.
Right.
There's Arthur's death, Miranda's
right.
marriage, which kind of ends. And Kirsten winds up suggesting that the more you remember, the more you've lost.
Absolutely.
So you're more interested in the book in exploring themes of loss and abandonment.
I'm interested in memory, and it's something that I've come back to in various ways throughout all of my books. It's fascinating to me the way that several different people can witness the same event and have completely different memories of it, which is something I've come back to, I suppose, in my previous book, most notably, The Lola Quartet, and here as well, which is why I do enjoy writing these books with multiple points of view.
Ever since Margaret Atwood won the Arthur C. Clarke Award in 1987 with The Handmaid's Tale, she's been denying that she writes science fiction.
Right.
What about you? Is this a science fiction book?
It's such a thorny question, genre. I've always set out to write literary fiction with the strongest possible plot and narrative drive. And an unexpected side effect of that has been that the focus on plot can push a writer kind of into the borderlines of genre. So what I discovered with my first novel is that if you write a literary novel with a crime in it, you've written a crime novel, which I have to say did come as a surprise. I wasn't expecting to be a crime writer. So this book it's a conscious departure from my first three novels, which were generally categorized as literary noir. I wanted to write something very different, just for the sake of not being pigeonholed as a crime writer, because I don't want to be pigeonholed as anything. But no, I did not specifically think of it as sci-fi. I object to the label only to the extent that it might prevent people from picking up the book. If people think, well, I only read literary novels, I'm not at all interested in science fiction. If that label prevents them from picking it up off the shelf, that's unfortunate. But there are such great books that have been categorized as science fiction that That's really my only objection to the label.
You're not worried about people going the other way, people who say, oh, I like science fiction, who might be scared off by it being described the other way, as a piece of literary fiction.
There is a little bit of that. It's so hard to strike that balance. I saw a blog comment about this book, and the man's comment was, I'm sorry, but I need my dystopias to have more chainsaw-wielding zombies. And, you know, that is out there, right? Some people have very specific ideas about what a dystopian novel is and isn't.
You say that you wanted to write literary fiction, but as well with a bit of plot.
Uh-huh, right.
Do you think literary fiction has a problem with plot?
Not necessarily, but, you know, to me, my idea of the perfect novel is The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is, of course, as literary as anything out there. Although, you know, try defining what literary fiction is. It's kind of a slippery thing. But also has a very strong narrative drive. I think literary fiction varies wildly in that regard. And I've read and loved some quote-unquote literary novels that had very little in the way of plot. I'm thinking particularly of Stoner, the novel by John Williams, which everyone was reading about 2 years ago, and rightfully so. It's a masterpiece. Very little happens in that book. It's a slow, quiet meditation on a man's life, and it's absolutely brilliant. Or Brooklyn by Cullum Tobin, a similar thing. So I love those novels. I think they can be very beautifully executed. Personally, I like writing something that does have a little bit more of a narrative drive.
That's just because that floats your boat, or that's just keeping the interest level for you as you write it?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
The latest estimates are suggesting that Ebola could kill 1.4 million people by the end of the year unless the response has stepped up. Has writing Station 11 changed how you feel about the apocalypse?
That's a good question. I would say no. Although it's interesting, as I did research into the history of epidemics, of course, when you start looking into it at all, you begin to realize that the history of humanity is in some ways a history of successive pandemics. And what's utterly disturbing is you realize that when you write a book in which much of civilization is wiped out by a pandemic, you're really starting from a non-fictional premise. This has happened again and again, and the book that I wrote is really just a massive exaggeration of it. And I'm thinking particularly of a somewhat haunting story I read in, I believe it was the 16th century, Captain George Vancouver sails up the west coast of the land that will later become Canada. And as they sail northward, he and his crew find themselves increasingly disconcerted. This is a beautiful land with a temperate climate. It's incredibly fertile, but there's nobody there. They go ashore and find villages capable of housing hundreds of people, but nobody home. They begin to find human skeletons on the beach. And when they do find survivors, the very few of them that are left, they have terrible scars and terrible stories. Smallpox has already come through. So this is something that's happened again and again, and it is unsettling to read about. It's terrible to read about the Ebola virus. The suffering in West Africa is unspeakable. I don't think that it changed the way I thought about the apocalypse very much. It did change the extent to which I take for granted the things that we have. You know, as you find yourself beginning to imagine what the world might look like without electricity, for example, or the difficulty of day-to-day life without running water.
Kirsten finds it maddening that other members of the Travelling Symphony aren't, as she says, science people. Have you become more of a science person?
Perhaps a little bit over the years, partly from the research and partly by nature of my day job, which is I'm a part-time administrative assistant at a cancer research lab in New York. I have such respect for what those people do. It's fascinating.
And when the apocalypse comes, it's kind of handy. Have you got a cupboard at home full of tinned food and torches and so on?
I do, but in fairness, that was before I started writing the book. There was a blackout in New York City in 2003, which was about a year after I'd come there, where the lights went out for, I think 36 hours. It was kind of wild. And then, of course, in the United States, there was Hurricane Katrina, wherein the citizens of New Orleans who weren't able to leave were utterly trapped without water. So I think that scared a lot of us into stocking up on the bottled water and the canned goods.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
C.
sickness is a far more slippery concept in Clemens J. Zetz's novel Indigo, which imagines a group of children who suffer from a mysterious syndrome which causes dizziness, headaches and vomiting in those around them. Assembled from reference material, photographs and cuttings, as well as first and third person narrative, Zetz evokes the future life of a former sufferer, as well as the story of a teacher at a school for indigo children named Clemens Zetz. And we caught up with the author in a tent at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. He began by reading a passage from the novel which describes the teacher's first day at the Helionau Institute.
"Max," he shouted, beckoning the boy toward us. "Is he?" The principal turned to me and nodded. "Yes, he's from here. A really sweet boy. One we've pinned our hopes on. His parents are incredibly nice too. His father recently purchased a paper mill from..." "Yes, Max, hello!" "Good morning," shouted the boy, remaining at about 10 yards distance. The principal approached him. The boy first backed away a little, then understood and extended his hand so that the principal could shake it. "Come on over," he said, waving me closer. "He doesn't bite, ha." The boy named Max held out his hand to me, and when I took it, I noticed that it was ice cold. Probably he was nervous. "We'll stay a few minutes," the principal said, with a kind smile in my direction. "So, yes, Max, this is Herr Zeitz. He's going to..." He made a gesture that was apparently supposed to signal that I should finish the sentence. "I'm doing my teaching internship here." The boy nodded. He put the empty birdcage down in the grass. "Yes," said the principal, enthusiastically. "He will serve as Professor Ungar's replacement." "Mm-hmm," said Max. A tick yanked his hand up, and he held the back of it against his lips. Then he brushed 3 times in a row with exactly the same movement an imaginary strand of hair from his forehead. I knew that I should ask something. "How are you? Do you like living here? What problems are there in everyday life? How do the teachers behave toward you?" Instead, I said, "Warm today, isn't it?" "Yeah, it's starting to get somewhat warmer again," said the principal. "Max, you're on your way to main building." "Yes, we were heading there too, yes. Great, great." The whole time, I couldn't help thinking, I feel nothing, nothing at all. A normal boy, a normal day, no effect, all in the head.
So tell us a little bit about this mysterious condition, the eye children who are at this institute in the mountains.
Yeah, it's a disease called the Indigo syndrome, where if you suffer from it, you actually don't have any symptoms, but everybody around you get sick. So that's what people are telling about a new kind of children, a new breed of children that's a worldwide phenomenon. And in Austria, there is a special school for these children at a very remote place where their needs are, accommodated, or they are accommodated in the way that they need to be.
And this chap, Clemens Zetz, starts working at the institute.
Yeah, that's sort of autobiographical fiction. I wanted to become a teacher of maths and German, and I have written myself into the book, and because I noticed that the character was me, and he, Clemens Zetz, starts his internship there and notices, apart from the already very strange circumstances, some very strange developments and occurrences, and he's very disturbed by that and goes into that.
The condition affects those around the children, as you say, but with things like headaches, dizziness, tired, they sometimes get, further than that, vomiting, diarrhea and so on. These are all things that parents of particularly young children will recognise are kind of the beginnings of these kind of symptoms, and it's something that you just push to a kind of more extreme level.
Yeah, I really, without consciously thinking about it, I took all these symptoms of burnout, I think it is called, psychosomatic things like skin rash or bad eyesight even, and something, dizziness and even sort of falling to the floor unconscious or something. And I tried to imagine a real disease, but then while doing that, I noticed that it became more and more transparent as something else, maybe a kind of mass hysteria, but that would be a stupid solution, I thought. Maybe there's something deeper and more mysterious about the texture of concrete reality. Maybe Maybe it's all, maybe we're living in our heads very much. I don't know, the book doesn't give answers, but I just went in there.
There are some in the book who think it's all nonsense, like you say. They think it's all in the mind. But we're very unprepared to accept that things that are in the mind have importance, have a reality.
Yes, I agree. The things that are just in the mind, like exhaustion and or pain and fear. I mean, I've done a little bit research in therapeutic hypnosis. Not the stage hypnosis, which is also fun to learn, but it's quite easy. It's just showmanship and magic things. But then there's also the therapeutic, and there's a guy called Milton Erickson who really could stop people sensing physical pain. But he could do it really for years, and I thought, how did he do this? And so is it just suggestion, or is it creating a whole world that is kind of a parallel universe? And I think Milton Erickson did it in a benign way, and that was interesting to me.
The novel is assembled as a kind of patchwork. There's bits of reference material. There's features written by this Clemens Zetz about the children. There's a third-person narrative of one of the children when slightly older. And there's photographs as well. But this is all this paraphernalia, an attempt to insist on the, or attempt for the reader to be able to take the slightly fantastical plot more seriously.
It probably was, although my model for that was W.G. Sebald, or W.G. Sebald, who also inserted lots of photographs in there. But the funny thing is that these photographs, although being kind of a document that proves something, they always make it so much more unbelievable. So you just stare at these and say, this can't be true. No, he did. I don't know how he gets to that effect, because usually that's not the way we read texts with photographs. Maybe some blogs that are sort of ironically written there, maybe. But I just thought that if I insert a proof that this happened, like in the end there's a house that goes up in flames and I have a picture of a burned out room, when I put it there I thought that this is just so much more bizarre if you see it, and people won't believe that it happens. And I like this effect somewhat.
It's a novel of mysterious disappearances. There's the men who go out for a cigarette and never return. There's the children who seem to vanish after dressing up as kind of odd characters of various sorts. Is this a particularly modern nightmare?
I think it is, yeah. I noticed many very good novels written about the disappearance of people. I mean, I don't know if... I think it's translated into English, Thomas Glavinich, a very brilliant Austrian writer. He has written a novel called Nightwork, Die Arbeit der Nacht. And it's about a person, a man, who wakes up and is alone in Vienna. Nobody else is there. Which, it sounds like an idea that somebody already had, and maybe there are thousands of books already, but this book is really breathtaking. It's amazing. You have to read it. I just want to shout out Thomas Glavinich. It's a masterpiece. And yeah, the disappearance of people, I mean, it's still something that it's shocking, because our world is, everything is on our radar. People are tweeting about themselves, and people are constantly reporting where they are. And people are, if they are answering their cell phone, they say, yeah, I'm on the bus right now. And it's just, everybody knows where everybody is. And we have tracking devices called cell phones with us. And everybody knows, and if nobody knows, at least the NSA supercomputer will know where we are. But then there are people just vanishing. And then maybe turning up 10 years later in some kind of dungeon or cellar somewhere in Austria.
So what's next for you in English and indeed in German?
In English, I don't know really. It depends, because there have to be special circumstances for a German book to be translated into English. So people have to. It has to be a long series of fortunate events. But in German next year, there will be two books coming out. A small book that I've made with a graphic novelist and sort of a comic artist. Of small texts, and then in fall of 2015 a very long book with about 1,000 pages, a novel which I've worked on 3 years. And yeah, I don't know if 1,000 page novel by an unknown Austrian writer will be translated into English. I can't say. I hope so.
Indigo is published in the UK by Serpent's Tale, while Picador publishes Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11. For the latest literary discussion, you can find us on SoundCloud, subscribe on iTunes, or join us on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Eva Krisiak, thanks for listening.